It's Lynn Rosetter Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today, it's garden rebel Catherine Whiteside. Now, she's the gardening authority with more shortcuts to a great vegetable garden than you can shake a stalk of rhubarb at. Her book is The Way We Garden Now. You know about going to New York for the restaurant scene, but how about going to New York for the picnic scene? It's a great picnic town, and Mike Colomeco tells us how to have Thomas Keller cater our lunch in the park. Self-described pleasure activist Fred Plotkin talks what we never knew about Helsinki, like the unforgettable seafood, the strawberries, and those intriguing fins. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started the way we do every week with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. Do you guys get to Portland, Oregon much? Because that is a city I have always felt I need weeks to really, you know, explore for the possibilities.
Isn't it fabulous? It's one of my favorite cities in the country. And every time we go there, we find a new discovery. And our latest discovery is a place called Voodoo Donuts.
Wait a minute. This sounds like New Orleans.
It does. It does. It's a goth donut shop in Portland.
Meaning not only are the people that run it kind of goth-looking, but
right.
The donuts themselves have a kind of goth character about them.
How do you do a goth donut?
Well, for example, you offer something on the menu called, quote, a non-existing fritter, the cost being zero.
And one of their donuts is called a dirty snowball. Another is a Diablo Rex.
Oh,
there's
this is
a
great
dirt donut.
And how about there's one called a Tex-Ass donut, which costs $3.95 because it is the size of a large serving platter.
But it's got that great Portland, you know, kind of hip but weird black humor attitude to it, which is
right.
Something you don't usually find along with your breakfast donuts.
But aside from the jokey stuff and the funny stuff, I found a pastry that I personally just love. Jane would have none of it. It's called a bacon maple bar. And what this is it's a substantial buttermilk long john, frosted with a kind of a thick maple glaze, and then festooned with a couple of strips of crisp bacon on top. It's like an all-in-one breakfast. Who couldn't love the idea of bacon and maple and a long john all together?
Jane, what's the problem? It sounds like the great, you know, the pancake, the maple syrup, and the bacon all in one. It sounds great.
Yeah, and it's kind of Elvis-y sounding also, but I think that somehow I was so swayed and seduced by the look of all the other more classical donuts that I just didn't want an all-in-one item. I wanted just a pure donut. And of course, Portland, like Seattle, is, you know, just has the greatest coffee in the world. So I think Voodoo serves Stumptown coffee, which is fabulous.
Brand.
Right. And oh my God, you know, you just can't go wrong with Voodoo Donuts.
And let me just say parenthetically, I mean, this wasn't all that interesting to us, but they have a whole shelf of vegan donuts available as well.
Well, you would have to. You would have to. But I guess two questions. First of all, is this a place like you sit down and you eat the donuts with the coffee, or is it takeout?
They've got a couple of shelves where you can stand and nosh, but there are no tables.
It's mostly a line of strange-looking people with tattoos and piercings waiting for their morning coffee.
And Jane and Michael Stern.
I never felt so old, so square, and so out of it as I did at Voodoo Donuts.
Yeah, but you know what? If you get into the donuts and whatever, you never know. The next thing you'll do is stop at the parlor for a piercing, and you know, you'll get
exactly. I mean, at least I have black hair. You know, that counts for something.
Jane, you're no goth, let me tell you.
She can try. Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
White on white, transducing black case, back on the rack. The little goose is dead, the bats have left the bell tower, the victims have been bled, 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 bled. black box. Bela Lugosi is dead.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Lately, I have been roasting chickens like a madwoman. We're in the throes of meeting a deadline for a cookbook. The recipe testing is done, and the writing is taking forever. Now, this means I have maybe 20 minutes a day to cook supper, which brings me back to those chickens. My husband and I could live on roast chicken. Now, I can turn it into more different dishes than you can shake a stick at, but there is no way that I am fiddling with overly fussy recipes. Which brings me to a gadget. Now, the idea is to get the chicken vertical so it crisps and all the fat drains off. Now, you could use the infamous beer can that Chef Steve Reichlin made mainstream, or you could use a gadget I love, the Spanic Vertical Roaster. It looks like a stainless steel Eiffel Tower. Now, all you do is preheat the oven to 450. You set the tower in a cake pan. You season your chicken, push it down on the tower, put some water in the pan, and roast the bird for 10 minutes to the pound plus 15 minutes. And it's done. We've had black olive garlic red wine chicken. We've had tandoori chicken. And tonight I think it's going to be lemon chicken. Don't be surprised if you see a cookbook show up next year with a dedication to a chicken. If you want to know eating in New York City, one person to go to is Mike Colomeco. Now, Mike's radio show, Food Talk, on WOR in New York City, covers the city's food scene, from eating on the cheap in Hell's Kitchen to going behind the kitchen doors in great restaurants. Now, Mike spent a lot of time in those kitchens in the past. He's a former chef. Hey, Mike, welcome.
Hey, always great to be here with you, Lynn.
There's one thing about New York I want to talk to you about. I don't think people realize what a great picnic town it is. People look at the city and they don't think about a picnic, but I know New Yorkers love it.
No, there's parks all over. You know, back in the day when I didn't have any money and I used to travel to Paris on a shoestring, you know, we'd save up money for like those 2-3-star restaurants, stay in a cheap hotel.
Right.
And we'd, you know, go buy a piece of pâté at a butcher, a baguette at a baker, a bottle of wine somewhere and a piece of cheese, and we'd eat in a park. You know, I'd bring my own corkscrew. I was so cheap because you can do this on the fly. And New York's got a lot of parks. So, you know, this is an interesting question, and here's a couple of different takes on it. The mother of all parks in Manhattan, Central Park. It's huge. Yeah. It's beautiful. It's open to the public in most areas. Great place for picnicking. And if you're looking for food, the whole Columbus Circle area has really come along ever since the time Warner Towers replaced that thing that was the old New York Coliseum. The Columbus Circle used to be kind of a dumpy area because the Javits Center replaced the Coliseum and the Coliseum sat dormant. But now you've got this amazing Time Warner Center. Thomas Keller is on the fourth floor at Perse, but he's got this beautiful little bakery on the third floor called Bouchon.
Ooh.
And it's typical Thomas Keller. I mean, he does a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but no. He makes his own cashew butter, his own apricot preserve, does it on his own pan de mie, cuts the crust off. It's to die for. They've got about a half a dozen to a dozen sandwiches that are superb, cold dishes like pâtés, soups, and pastry that's, I mean, it's arguably one of the top three pastry places in the city, and beautiful packaging.
Right.
Get takeout at Bouchon, walk across the park, and you're not going to live much better. Now, say you're downtown.
Okay.
Greenwich Village has this whole British history thing. I mean, it was founded by the British and hence the name Greenwich. There's a little tiny park that's been renovated in the last 10 years called Abingdon Square. And I love it. It's named after some Lord of Abingdon or something. And who cares about the history? But it's cute. It's got seats. It's funny. It's right between kind of Hudson, just north of Bleecker. And it's this little like Brit section of town. Just to the north of it's a store called Myers of Keswick.
Myers of Keswick.
Do you remember the cat in New York that got stuck in the building for 2 weeks? Did that make national news? There was
a cat.
Is the building. That's his cat. That brings it home to your listening audience. Remember, the cat's still – I saw the cat the other day. He's fine. He's living in a shoebox.
Okay.
Myers of Keswick, they sell this it's staffed by British guys and gals. So you walk in and everyone's like, hey, mate, how you do? Or is that Australian? I don't know. All the British expats shop there. Everyone that works there is British. And I just ask them, what's out of the oven? because they do all their own baking. So they've got Cornish, I'm not going to pronounce this, I'm going to, Cornish pasties.
I call them pasties. I think that's correct. Yeah.
That's correct. I said pasties and they got, it's pasties, mate. Oh, sorry. Cornish pasties, Scotch eggs, all these great little typical British things with like little meats and sausages wrapped up in dough, mincemeat pies, all fresh made daily, hot. You could pick that up, wander down the street. I mean, they're like a little Tesco. They're a block from Abingdon Square. And there's another, a couple of blocks to the east of this, a fish and chips place called, and this is a pun, Salt and Battery, spelled A, then S-A-L-T. You got to love the Brits. But it's like great fish and chips, and it's on Greenwich Street. And, you know, you've got this whole Brit thing going. My last suggestion, I'm going to squeeze it in, is, and I got to shout out to one of the last great delis in New York, Katz's Deli.
Oh,
go to Katz's. Go to get, you know, this is the, when Harry Met Sally, the famous place, Lower East Side,
Houston Street,
kind of like by Allen and by First. Grab a sandwich there to go. Anything from pastrami, corned beef, brisket, you can't go wrong. Some of the best hot dogs in the city. A big one called a Nobelwurst. It's like a big garlicky kind of a German hot dog that's great. And then go up 8 blocks to Tompkins Square Park, which is in the middle of the Lower East Side. You know, this was this famous park that for years was kind of dangerous and drug-riddled and crazy. It's completely gentrified. It's a real great piece in New York. Charlie Parker lived across the street for years. And, you know, Tompkins Square Park, it's like one of the hottest neighborhoods in the city now.
Huh.
You know, years ago, everyone came to this part of New York and they wanted to move north, the grandparents.
They came
to Delancey. They came to Orchard. They made enough money and they moved to the Upper East and West Side.
Right.
Now, all their grandkids have come back to Delancey and Orchard. Nobody wants to be north of 14th Street anymore. Who knew?
Should have bought back then, right?
Please.
The
everybody's comment.
Yes, exactly. Hey, Mike, though, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike Colomeco hosts Food Talk on WOR Radio in New York City. Now, you can get Mike's picnic finds and my recipe for roast asparagus potato salad on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, if you're picnicking in Central Park near 73rd Street and you have a yen for one of the best cappuccinos in the city, go to Via Quadrano. It's a stand-up coffee bar with truly exquisite cappuccino. And in the back, there's a cozy, here that is crowded, restaurant with good light Italian dishes and sandwiches. I've put Via Quadrano's address up on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, be sure to register for Weeknight Kitchen, a newsletter devoted to simplifying your culinary life midweek. Now, each week we send you a weeknight supper recipe and gems of great wisdom and piercing insight. And even more to the point, Weeknight Kitchen is free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the dream vegetable garden for the horticulturally impaired and a pleasure activist's guide to Helsinki. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. For a long time, I have felt that there were those of us who were meant to garden and those of us who were meant to encourage them, as in showing up with a big salad bowl to carry home the baby lettuces, trimming back their herbs for them when they're not around, or offering to take all those gorgeous tomatoes off of their hands. But gardening expert Catherine Whiteside might turn me around. She's the author of The Way We Garden Now. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, Catherine, I always start out with this great idea. I'm going to have a little garden. It's going to be like those French potagerie gardens, you know, where you have the vegetables and the flowers and some beautiful salads. And I start it, and ultimately it is so much work. I just end up with weeds, you know, by the end of June. Is there an easy way to do this?
Absolutely. And I always look for the easy way. I'm kind of a lazy girl. you know, really, with four raised beds, which are just basically wood boxes, you can grow quite a lot of salad.
How much space do I actually need?
You know, it's totally up to you. I tend to make my raised beds like 5 feet by 5 feet, but yeah, they could be 3 feet by 3 feet.
So how do you decide what to grow?
Well, I really recommend if you are a beginner, plant one of your boxes with as many different kinds of lettuces as you can find.
Okay.
And I tend to plant the loose leaf lettuces because you can just cut them leaf by leaf.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds painstaking, but it's not. You can cut a salad in 2 minutes.
Can I get things like tomatoes and beans into that kind of garden?
Absolutely. You're going to plant tomatoes and beans later in the season. I don't really plant them until June the 1st. And one of the tricks is when the lettuce bolts, you know, when it starts making a pyramid and getting bitter.
Yeah, right.
I pull the whole thing up and I push a bean down in the hole.
Ah.
And, of course, with the tomatoes, you know, that's a longer taking crop.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath it, you can grow cilantro, you can grow basil, because those are also heat lovers.
Now, what about flowers? Because I understand that sometimes flowers need a different kind of soil than vegetables and edibles.
You can certainly grow nasturtiums and borage, which has beautiful tiny blue flowers, which taste like cucumbers.
Oh, yes.
Chives, you know, make a beautiful purple flower. You can eat that. And also, I eat my daylily buds.
I've never had them, but I've understood they really are delicious.
They are delicious.
Okay, Catherine, what is somebody with your gardening karma doing now?
Oh, I love my tomatoes. I really do. And, you know, I don't cook them to make paste.
Uh-huh.
I grate them on the cheese grater and put the pulp in a plastic bag in the freezer. And when I need it, I just break off a piece in
the winter. That's a great idea. That really
it is wonderful. A great chef taught me that.
Is there a particular tomato that you're in love with at this point?
Well, I like Brandywines, just like everyone does, but that's one of the ones I call a slicer.
Mm-hmm.
For grating, I tend to use the old French paste tomatoes and the Italian ones. And my French and Italian is so awful. I hope you're not going to make me say the names, but you will see them. You will see them labeled. And I'll tell you another plant that I really enjoyed last year, and I'm definitely going to plant it again, is patty pan squash.
Oh, the little ones.
I ate the blossoms, and I picked the squash when they were tiny, like the size of a quarter.
Oh, I don't think I've ever had them that small.
They were absolutely extraordinary.
You know, there's something I'm seeing more and more of in the market, watercress. Is watercress hard to grow? Do you have to have a stream or some deep water to do it?
Well, you know, that's sort of the conventional wisdom, but last year, I thought, you know, I'm going to try this thing. I'm always doing this. This is what a garden rebel I am. I'm going to try something that they say can't be done.
Mm-hmm.
I took a huge old wash tub, you know, just like those big galvanized tubs.
Yeah.
And I, with a nail in the bottom, I punched a few holes, but not enough that it would drain quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I filled it up with compost. I planted watercress in it. And I watered it just as I watered the rest of the garden, you know, with the sprinkler when it needed it. But it held the water longer, and the watercress was amazing.
Do you cut it like lettuce? I mean, do you just trim off the leaves, or do you take the stems and all?
Well, the stems are very, unlike the watercress you buy in the grocery store, the stems are very tender. So you can kind of, you know, give it a little crew cut, and then it comes back.
Oh, that's great.
It is great.
Catherine, what about growing berries?
Berries are a little bit trickier. You need a little bit more space. I would definitely say plant them along the edges of your yard.
Uh-huh.
But let me tell you something that I am totally into is rhubarb. That will definitely fit in your vegetable garden. And besides making all the pies you could ever eat, last year I started making rhubarb margaritas, which one of my girlfriends promptly baptized rhubarb burritos. And let me tell you something, I'm going to have rhubarb in my garden for the rest of my life.
All right, now wait a minute. Do you just puree the rhubarb into the margarita?
Well, it's so simple. You basically make a rhubarb simple syrup, you know, just
right.
the way you make a simple syrup. And then you drain it out. So you've got this wonderful pink tart syrup, and you bang in the tequila and the limes, and you are ready to go. And if you have somebody who doesn't want tequila, you can substitute lemonade, and it makes a delicious lemonade.
Catherine, what a wonderfully realistic and hedonistic look at gardening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine Whiteside is author of The Way We Garden Now. Now, she left us with her rhubarb burrito recipe. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And happy spring. Pleasure activist Fred Plotkin was born to explore and interpret. Now, he travels the planet. In each city he visits, he seems to instinctively pick up on the local culture's beliefs, politics, and those pieces of history that shape character and the food. His hedonist side usually unearths food places not in the guidebooks. Now, Helsinki has been on Fred's itinerary. Fred, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, now when I think Helsinki, Fred, I think Arctic Circle and reindeers on Main Street. Can you give me a more accurate picture of what the city is about?
Actually, Helsinki is a very glamorous capital. It has modern design. It has more people using cell phones, if we like that or not, than anywhere else because the cell phone was invented there.
It was invented in Helsinki?
Yeah. This is where Nokia is. And the Finns originally created cell phones to communicate over long distances. If you're a reindeer herder and you have to find out where the other herd is, you call up your friend.
Ah.
So Helsinki is part 1920s Jugendstil, a lot of contemporary architecture, grand boulevards, beautiful gardens, water everywhere, and people who are friendly once you really warm them up.
So what are the Finns like? Because I've heard the Finnish people perhaps take life very seriously.
Well, they have to take life seriously because they live in a place where they were for many years sandwiched between the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union on one side and the Swedish Empire on the other side. So they really had to find themselves and their own identity and their language in their music, in their soil, in their food, and so on. And there's an almost mythical quality to Finland, because remember, most of Europe had kings and queens. The Finns have no royal heritage, and for that reason, they found who they were unto themselves. It's a very I'll help you, you help me society.
Mm-hmm.
Transparency International calls it the most ethical and fair-minded country in the world, and I believe that to be true in my experience. And the other thing I said before, that the Finns are better when you warm them up. Where do you warm them up? But in a sauna. They invented the sauna. Now, this is one of the great contributions to world culture. In other places, we think of it perhaps as slightly pornographic or sexy. For the Finns, it was literally about warming up, about finding refuge, about a place that's sacred. And in fact, saunas are where childbirth often happened, where the dead were laid out at their end. And in between, you go there to restore, to perspire, to communicate, to commune. And in fact, you remember the Helsinki Accords of 1977?
Yes, yeah.
Gerald Ford and Leonid Brezhnev met their agreement in a sauna.
All right, but the important things, do you eat in the sauna?
You don't so much eat in there because it's too hot, but you step outside to cool down, and then immediately there's food right there for you. That's part of the tradition.
So what's food in general like in Finland?
Food in general is like the Finns themselves, that they really want to identify and harvest it in a way that it expresses their land. You see, they have this thing called sisu, S-I-S-U. And the way I translate that is, if a Finn, faces a wall, rather than jump over the wall or go around the wall, he'll butt through the wall until he gets to the other side. It's about challenging yourself. And similarly, when a lot of the land is frozen over or it's so far north the growing seasons are short, you really have to work incredibly hard and be very resourceful and self-reliant to produce good food of any kind. But Finnish cuisine now is great. Jacques Chirac of France recently poo-pooed Finnish food, but what does he know? One of the great things in Finland is that all the local waters provide fish all the year. And one of the great fishes there is called muiki, M-U-I-K-K-I, which is like a pike perch, and they grill them. There's something called vendas, which has an orange roe that they eat with sour cream and onion and thick blini that look like rusks, the best herring in the world. We think of herring only as pickled herring, but they eat it fresh. They butterfly it, they bread it with rye flour, and they cook it in butter in a pan. It's magnificent. There is an amazing salmon soup that I crave all the time. There is reindeer that I don't crave all the time, but once in a while it's very good. The thing to remember about Finland, about 65% of the country is covered in forests. So in those forests you find game, you find magnificent wild mushrooms of all kinds. And then, to top it all, in the summer for about 2 weeks are the world's most magnificent strawberries. Simple reason. If the sun is not out for most of the winter and then it's out all the time in the spring, the intensity of flavor and color that happens with these berries, they're not big woody berries. They're tiny and they collapse in your mouth and it's a strawberry blast. It's just great. It's heaven.
Fred, is Helsinki an expensive city?
Helsinki was an expensive city until it went on the euro. And somehow prices have moderated a bit as Finland has become the first Nordic country to be part of the European Union, along with Denmark. Those two were the first. So therefore, it has integrated into Europe. It's not cheap, but frankly, I've been to much more expensive cities. London and Paris certainly are higher than Helsinki. And the hotels are very good and quality reasonable. There are a lot of hotels I like there. One of them is called the Torni, T-O-R-N-I, that also has one of the great kitchens, restaurants in Helsinki.
Fred, sounds like one of those places you have to get to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fred Plotkin is author of Italy for the Gourmet Traveler.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just
pick up that phone and we will talk. The number is 800-537-5252. Okay, let's get going. We have got Carolyn on the phone from Carmel Valley, California. Carolyn, what do you want to talk about?
I'd like to talk about learning to make traditional okashi, which is the sweet offered to the guest in Japanese tea ceremony.
Oh, you're not picking anything hard, are you?
Well, that's why I'm asking you. I haven't been able to find anything in books or online.
Ah, are you studying Japanese food? Do you cook a great deal of it?
I'm studying Japanese tea ceremony. I'm a beginner student.
And you want to try to make the okashi?
Yes, and there's one in particular that it tastes like adzuki beans with sugar on the inside and mochi on the outside.
Right, the sweet glutinous rice on the outside. This is what I can tell you. I've never made it. I've had it. We were having versions of it when we were in Hawaii. And it's a wonderful sweet. Now, my understanding is, isn't it true? Okashi is sort of the general term for the sweets?
Yes.
Yeah. There is one place I would go first. And it's a book that came out in the 1980s.
And it is written by a Japanese man who, from what I understand, was passed away, but was one of the people who was considered to be one of the great classical traditionalists of Japanese cuisine. And and this is all I can tell you about it. It's called Japanese Cooking, A Simple Art. And I know he had a fascinating section on how to work with glutinous rice and the adzuki beans and how to make sweets. And I would bet that that is one of the great places to look, because his recipes were, they always tasted wonderful. I haven't cooked from the book in a long time. But B, I would bet you that if there is an authentic way of doing it, he's going to be the person who's going to know it.
Okay.
And I think, you know, now you can buy mochi powder, M-O-C-H-I powder. I think you've probably seen it in groceries. But
I'd like to pound my own rice.
Yes, and that's what I was going to say. My understanding is that the way you do this is you make glutinous rice and you actually pound it yourself. Mm-hmm. This is the book to look for. Japanese Cooking, A Simple Art.
Great. Thank
and
you.
And you'll find it online. Hey, okay. Take care. You know, when we were in Hawaii, it was very interesting because mochi is a standard. It's in every store and every snack bar. And what it is glutinous rice. It can be sweetened. And at first, you're struck by the fact that it's kind of gummy. It's almost like a paste, and it'll surround a filling, or it will be tinted, or it will be flavored. But after a while, you start to crave it. And there's butter mochi, where the rice powder or the pounded glutinous rice is mixed with butter and sugar and egg, and it's baked. There's all of these treats, and it is all coming out of Japan, and it really makes you realize that the bulk of the population of those islands are all of Japanese descent. So, you know, where we see candy bars in a market, next to the candy bars would be the mochi. Interesting. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, it's about celebrity on the web. The question is, what is edible, has been invited to a wedding, and has a website that has had nearly 1 million hits? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to get back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, it was a question about celebrity on the web. And the question was, what is edible, has been invited to a wedding, and has a website that's had nearly 1 million hits? Well, it's a cheddar cheese. The cheddar cheese that you can see being filmed live on Cheddar Vision TV. The cheese just sits there, and it's a big cylinder covered with proper cheese mold sitting on a shelf with other cylinders. Now, there are big action moments. Every morning, you can see the cheese turned by an official cheese turner. Now, this site makes the Yule log on TV look like an action movie. The story behind Cheddar Vision is that British cheesemaker Tom Calver wanted to show what it takes to create a real farmhouse cheddar. So he's filming the cheddar in real time. Well, the film's been running since December, and in that time, the cheese has received a Valentine, a wedding invitation, chocolate Easter bunnies, and nearly 1 million hits. Okay, let's get back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who has been waiting patiently. We have Christopher calling from Phoenix. Hey, Christopher, what do you want to talk about?
About a year ago, my wife and I, we decided to cut out food with hydrogenated oil.
And
we started having problems finding, you know, a lot of stuff that didn't have it in it, you know, prepared food.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, and it really kind of came to a head when we were like, we got our crock pot, and we got a crock pot recipe book, and every single one of those crock pot recipes seems like calls for a condensed soup, which is filled with hydrogenated oil.
Yeah, and with preservatives and a lot of other things.
Exactly,
yeah.
Stuff that we don't want in our bodies.
Exactly, yeah.
And so we were looking for when the recipe calls for that, what do we use instead?
I don't mean to sound like a, you know, a wise guy, but I want to get you another book on crockpot cooking.
Okay.
No, because I'll tell you one thing. Yeah, there are a lot of books out there. I can't think of a name offhand. You know, heaven forbid I should have one on the tip of my tongue. But one of the things is any stew recipe generally can be done in a crock pot. So if you run across a recipe in another book, you know, or another source,
right,
know that generally you can do it in the crock pot. But if you want to get cream of mushroom soup is probably the one that you use the most, right?
Right.
Yeah. You can't duplicate it exactly, but essentially what you want to do is take a mess of mushrooms and sauté them in a big pan with, you know, olive oil you could do, or you could do olive oil and butter. I would say from the saturated fat point of view, go with olive oil. And you want high heat, pretty high heat. You want them sliced, and you're going to sauté them with some onion. And you're going to get that brown. You're going to get them almost crisp. They're going to throw off a lot of liquid in the beginning, and then you're just going to keep cooking it. And what you're going to do is add a little garlic at the end, and then you're going to throw in a little bit of white wine and boil it down to absolutely nothing. And then you're going to take – even canned broth would work here, like a half a cup of canned broth.
Sure.
Boil it down to nothing. Now, by the way, you can do this en masse and stick it in small quantities in the freezer and then pull it out. All right?
Wow.
Okay. And then what you're going to do is stir in a little bit of cream and just cook that for about 4 or 5 minutes. Now, what you've got there is a really concentrated base of flavor.
Okay.
And again, if you don't want to use the cream, you could use more wine. You could use more broth.
Okay.
But the cream, it's that cream that is giving you part of the texture of the dish. Now, that could replace the concentrated thing. And the other thing you could do is look up a sauce called a white sauce or a bechamel. They're the same thing.
Sure.
That's where you cook, you know, flour and butter together, and then you add milk. But you can make that really sexy by adding more milk than is called for and adding some cut-up onion, a clove, some carrots, some celery, some bay leaves, and you simmer that slowly so that you get this really flavorful white sauce.
Okay.
And then you can strain it and add sautéed mushrooms or add whatever you want to it, and that becomes your sauce base. But what you want is something intensely flavored that then becomes the foundation of whatever you cook.
Okay.
And that can take you. But let me throw out another thought for you. The saving grace from a health point of view would be any tomato sauce that looks interesting.
Okay.
Because that you can also just add just the way you would a can of canned soup.
Okay.
Okay? And you can make that yourself in no time. You can stick it in the freezer. You can have it in the fridge, and it's easy.
Well, that sounds great.
All right.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Sure.
You take care.
All right.
You know, if you're into crockpot cooking, check out any recipe or any cookbook that has the word braise in the title. And what braising means is that whatever the basic ingredient is, if it's green beans or if it's chicken, you brown it, usually with things like onion because they're so aromatic. And then you add some kind of liquid, usually something flavorful, and you let it cook. And it's the way you can tenderize tough cuts. And you can put that in a crock pot and let it go. You know, like for instance, you can take chunks of beef chuck and brown them with some onion and lots of garlic. And you can throw in vinegar and you can throw in red wine and you can add vegetables. And you put that all in the crock pot and you can get this really dynamite stew out of it. So just remember the magic word, two magic words, braise or stew. If it says braise or stew, that can go in your crock pot. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Phil calling from Washington, D.C. Hey, Phil, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. It's about making hash.
Oh, gosh, I love hash.
Okay, so do I, and I used to do it well. When I was a bachelor, I had brunches often, small brunches, brunches for two.
That's small. That's really small. I like brunches for two, personally.
Yeah. But I would buy corned beef or roast beef or something like that and take it home and cut it up into a large dice, I guess, half inch anyway, and do the same with potatoes. And I'd brown some onions and cook it all together. Somewhere along the line, I forgot how to do it. I got married. I raised a son. He's 24 now. my wife and I are getting back to brunches. Okay?
For two.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, brunch when, with him around, you know, you'd have to make four times as much. But I can't get the recipe right. I can't get it to work the way it did in the old days. Now, and I can't remember whether I parboiled the diced potatoes or not. I've tried it both ways.
Did.
I made the dice bigger, yeah. smaller. I can't get it right.
You know what I wonder? What kind of pan were you using then, and what kind of pan are you using now?
The same cast iron frying pan.
And
I think it's the same one.
Are you really browning everything well? In so many words, not really crowding the pan?
No. No, I crowd it.
Don't crowd it.
Oh, don't crowd it.
Don't crowd it. Parboil the potatoes.
Yeah.
Okay, so because it's, you know, hash isn't, it's about cooking something. But hash is about things that are already done,
sure.
being kind of wonderfully browned and mushed together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the key things, it's like laying the foundation of a building. If you don't have it, the building will fall apart. You got to get those onions brown. You got to get that meat crusty. And you got to get those potatoes crusty. And if you do that, you know, maybe you throw some sweet peppers in it, or you do, yeah. you add whatever seasoning. But if you get those babies really crusty, it's got to be good. I mean, it's really something that you can't go wrong with hash. And it's the biggest problem with most restaurants that make hash.
Yeah.
They throw it all in the pot. It could be a stew. And that's not what hash is. It starts to all blend together after you've done the browning. Now, this may not be the way you made it originally. I'm not sure, but that's sort of my mantra about hash.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
But hopefully that'll, hopefully that'll bring back the golden olden days.
Right. Hey, thanks a million.
You know, I'm so glad that brunches are back in your life. This is a very good thing. And thanks for calling.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. Right now, I want some hash so bad I cannot tell you. You can reach us 800-537-5252. Something I and a lot of other people have been waiting for has finally happened. A Pulitzer Prize has been awarded to a food writer, a restaurant critic. Okay, not a restaurant critic, the restaurant critic, who has already racked up a lot of awards. He is Jonathan Gold, restaurant critic of LA Weekly. Jonathan, good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Especially under these circumstances. How does it feel?
It feels great. As a food writer, you never expect anything like this. As a writer for an alternative news weekly, you never expect anything like this. So it's just, it's been really sweet.
Why do you think food has been ignored all this time in terms of writing about, you know, critical writing?
I think because people tend not to think of food as one of the fine arts.
Mm-hmm.
And that the award tends to, as it probably should most of the time, go to, you know, people writing about art and architecture and books. But the skills of a good food critic, I think, are pretty much the same. You need a lot of physical description. You need to put things in context. You need to sort of tease the historical context out of what you're writing about. And, you know, writing about food is the only kind of writing you can do about a biological function that the censors don't get all hot about.
I never thought about it that way before. Stepping back a bit from it,
sure.
Do you think that this says something about where we are with food in this country at this point?
It may, and I hope it does. It, you know, food books are selling very well. The food memoir has become a literary category unto itself. And people are starting to realize that the food we eat and how it's grown and where it comes from and how much care people take in preparing it for us is one of the most important things in the world. I mean, it says so much about us as a community and says so much about us as a country.
And you talk a lot about that in what you write. What drives your writing?
I love going to restaurants, and I love food. And as you know from doing this show for so long, people who are fascinated with food are really fascinated with food. They're absolutely obsessed, and they're the kind of people you want to hang out with because their passion for what they're doing is just unsurpassed. And every time I walk into a new restaurant, even if it's a strange Cambodian place or someplace stuck mm-hmm. under a freeway, mm-hmm. I always have the expectation that I'm going to have the best meal of my life or that I'm at least going to taste something that I've never had before.
It's like being, you know, it's the proverbial vision of the kid on Christmas morning, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I imagine to be a theater critic, you have to have that, you know, sort of that excited feeling in your gut every time a curtain goes up.
Yeah. Well, I think to be a critic of anything.
Yeah. Sure.
If you lose that, you've lost the reason why you're doing it. In looking at some of your writing, it looks like you're writing about communities, too. You're writing about communities within that L.A. area.
Right. And Los Angeles is, in my opinion, the best eating city in the world. I mean, we have... not just the high-end restaurants, which are very good. I mean, I think a lot of what we now know as new American cooking came out of Los Angeles and the sort of experiments that chefs there were doing in the mm-hmm. 80s. But the, for want of a better word, ethnic communities. You know, we have more Koreans here than in any city outside of Korea. We have more Mexicans here than we do in Guadalajara. We have, you know, the largest communities of Thais, of Cambodians, of Chinese, of Japanese in the country, and they're all cooking to remind themselves of home.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible privilege to be able to go in and be able to eat that food.
Jonathan, what other critics do you read? Who perhaps spurs you or inspires you?
Well, from the time I was in high school and Ruth Reichel was at New West Magazine, I've admired her. She's a very fine critic. I think Dara Moskowitz in the City Pages in Minneapolis does mm-hmm. a fantastic mm-hmm. job. Mm-hmm. I think Robert Seitzman at the Village Voice has an incredible voice and a beautiful style, and he approaches the restaurants of New York, I think, almost like a 19th century taxonomist going into the Amazon jungle. I mean, his thirst to know everything about New York is just amazing, and I consider it a privilege to read his columns.
Huh. You have children, right?
Yeah, I have two children.
And are they old enough to, I mean, do they ever go to work with you, I guess? Do you take them out with you when you're reviewing?
All the time. I mean, some of the best times I've ever had are driving across Italy with my daughter. And my daughter Isabel is passionate about Italian food especially. So she wants to go and eat pasta and Modena, and she wants to go see how Parmesan cheese is made in Reggio Emilia. And she's a 12-year-old, and I think the happiest I've ever seen her was sitting down at a tasting menu when they brought an appetizer that was 14 different kinds of squid and octopus and cuttlefish. The tentacles just sent her into heaven.
I love this kid. I haven't even met her yet.
Well, you actually have. We met at Greenbrier when she was just
that's
1 year
right.
old.
That's right. Well, she was tiny at that time.
She was tiny, yeah.
Who could see all this potential?
Exactly.
Hey, Jonathan, thanks for talking with us, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Gold writes the counterintelligence column for LA Weekly. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, the answering machine loves to hear from you. Call us, 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this thought from 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner, poet Robert Frost. He said, and I'm quoting, "The reason why worry kills more people than work is that more people worry than work." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website,
splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. And you can also download our weekly podcast. And best of all, they're both free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Alexis Donaff. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Please join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.